And it's time for On Our Minds. So we spent the first part of this hour rethinking how we talk about climate change in the future. And that got us wondering, what could happen if we also change the way we think about money? One book that started a conversation across the country about the role of money in our lives is Sacred Economics by Charles Eisenstein. Steve Paulson sat down with its author to get the skinny.
Charles, you've written a great deal about how we might rethink our economic system and specifically how we use money. What do you see as the fundamental problem with how money shapes our lives?
Yeah, I think that the fundamental problem goes a lot deeper than is ordinarily recognized. I think it goes down to the way that money is created and circulates. Basically, to make a very long story short, it's created as interest-bearing debt, which means that there's always more debt than there is money, so that scarcity, anxiety, and competition and the need for endless growth are kind of built into the money system.
So how does this affect us in our daily lives?
Well, the phrase, there's always more debt than there is money, might resonate with a lot of people, or the experience of there never being enough money. And you look around, you know, and you can ask what seem like naive questions. Like if we're becoming more and more productive and we have more and more technology, then why does it seem that we have to work harder and harder? Or why, like on the governmental level, why are there all of these functions that in the 50s and the 60s we could easily afford, but now we can no longer afford them?
Give me some examples of what you mean.
Well, how about public education? In the 60s, it was basically free. Tuition was very, very low. And now it's, you know, we can no longer afford to do that, supposedly. Or a lot of municipal services, libraries, parks, even police forces are being scaled back.
So what has changed since the 1950s or 60s when a lot of those government services were easy to pay for?
Well, we have, as you may have noticed, kind of this ongoing financial crisis that surfaced in 2008 and which is now still kind of simmering under the surface. But basically, more and more of our productivity is channeled toward meeting our debt obligations. And more money is in the hands of people or banks, you know, corporations who don't need to spend it.
Hmm. Now, you've written a book called Sacred Economics, which I have to say sounds kind of like an oxymoron here. But are you talking about finding a way to make money sacred?
Yeah, you know, I asked the question, why does it seem that money is the enemy of all of the beautiful things we want to do? And why is it that when you ask, why are we destroying the rainforests? You know, why are we doing all these terrible things on the planet? Somebody's making a profit from it. And on a personal level, too, for many, many people, the beautiful, noble, generous thing that you want to do in your life, there's not a lot of money in that. And the money, you know, on some level is destructive, but hey, man, I got to feed my family. Why shouldn't money be aligned with what's good and beautiful and sacred? That's the starting question.
So how do we do that? I mean, how do we align money, buying things, selling things to correspond to our values?
You can buy green products, fair trade products. You can try to align your purchasing decisions with your values. But at some point, you realize that the whole system is complicit in ecocide, and that systems change is necessary too. It's not just about changing personal habits. One of our new values, which of course is also a very ancient value, but it's care for the planet. But our economic system encourages the opposite. Very often you can pollute, you can emit carbon or emit sulfur dioxide or draw down aquifers, and you don't pay the costs. Future generations pay the costs, but you get the profits. So one thing that we can do to realign is to internalize these costs, green taxes, perhaps a carbon fee and dividend, so that the best ecological decision can be aligned with the best business decision.
What about at a more personal level? I mean, just in terms of how we use money in our day-to-day lives, is there a way we can construct our lives so that money is not so all-important, sort of always there hanging over us?
I think a lot of people want to reclaim some of life for money. You know, we pay for things today that a generation ago, or especially 100 years ago, people didn't pay for. For example, when I was a kid, we didn't really pay for food preparation. Mom cooked, and occasionally we'd go out to a restaurant. Today, something like 60 or 70% of all meals are prepared outside the home, either at restaurants or supermarket delis, you know. So this is a human function that's been monetized and that a lot of people want to reclaim. There's a whole movement called reskilling that involves relearning these ways of taking care of ourselves and each other without paying somebody to do that.
Are you talking about cooking classes or something more elaborate than that?
Well, I mean, it could be learning how to fix things, learning how to build things, child care co-ops, tool libraries, you know, instead of every house having their own set of power tools. Like, how often do you use your electric drill?
Right.
You know, like 15 minutes a year, maybe. So why not have like a, you know, a big tool shed in the middle of the neighborhood where everybody goes to?
So, you, I mean, it sounds like what you're really saying is we need more of a sense of community built into daily life. Because, I mean, of course, the thing that money allows us to do is we can just go out and buy whatever stuff we want. And we can do that basically without having to interact with other people in a meaningful way. And you're saying that's the root of the problem here.
Well, it's pretty deep down, you know. A lot of people really want to have community, but they also want their financial independence. Those two things are contradictory. I think that the economic crisis is rooted in a much deeper crisis and a much deeper transition. I call it our deep mythology. Why are we here? What is a human being? What's important? The dominant mythology today is of the separate self. You know, it says who you are is a separate individual in a world that is other, that's really indifferent to you. And the more you control, then that's less for me. So more for you is less for me. So we're all in competition with each other. But I think that that's changing. So in a community, it's not true that more for you is less for me. In a community, your well-being enables you to contribute more. So that's to my well-being as well.
Well, you've written about what you call a gift economy. What are some of the elements of that?
A gift economy consists of the ways that people take care of each other that are not mediated by money. And it's not barter either. A gift, you give it without being in control of what you were going to receive.
So it's not, you know, I fix your car so you will paint my living room.
Right. But if I fix your car and I contribute to the community in other ways, then I feel secure and I know from watching everybody else and watching how the community works, I know that those who do that, if they are in need, they'll be taken care of too.
Are you advocating abolishing money?
No. I guess you could say I'm a degrowth advocate. I think that the monetized realm needs to shrink, but I do think that it has its proper domain.
So play this out for me. So what would be, in your ideal world, what would be the kinds of things that we would spend money on and what other things would happen without any money involved?
Well, I think that anything that requires a global or at least a translocal coordination of labor and resources is going to have to be mediated somehow by money, like electronics, you know, computers, automobiles, anything that requires a vast division of labor across the planet is going to require money. But a lot of functions that could be local and should be local today are also translocal, especially the production of food, you know, the production of building materials, the production of entertainment to a large extent. When I go to less, quote, developed countries, I find that people sing a lot more. They play a lot more. They don't purchase songs as much. And there's more sharing.
And what about for you personally? I mean, how have you, or have you, managed to somehow reduce the amount of your life that is monetized?
Well, I mean, I do a lot of my work on a gift basis. So, for example, my books are available online in their entirety. If you choose to pay me, you can. And I want to credit my publisher for being brave enough to try this. And a lot of my events are the same way. You choose the price.
It probably also means that you're not as rich as you probably could be.
Hey, yeah, I mean, like, I'm not getting rich, of course, but, you know, if I hadn't put it out there, maybe it wouldn't have spread virally, you know? Maybe, like, a lot of our logic that says that well-being comes through control isn't true.
That's Sacred Economics author Charles Eisenstein. You can hear an extended version of Steve's conversation with him on our website, ttbook.org, where you can also find interviews on slow money, central bankers, and a whole lot more.